So where do we find the energy and the skill to do this, when we have been so affected internally by these gangs that it's all we can take care of just to get ourselves and our own families in order? Where the hell does the energy come to care for humanity when it's more than I can cope with taking care of me? My government sells weapons when peace is what we need, and our compassionate nature is buried beneath our greed. With divine energy within us, how tragic we breed such fear and let violence and starvation kill millions of us each year. I see people on the streets not getting enough, but how can I help them when making it myself is rough? Our prisons are a disgrace, our mental hospitals too, but burying my head in the sand is easy to do. I get sicker every day from all the oppression I see, but worrying about losing what I've got makes a coward out of me. Where the hell does the energy come to care for humanity when it's more than I can cope with taking care of me? So in our trainings, we want people to come out not only with awareness of how nonviolent communication can be used internally to transform our inner world. We want people to see how it can be used to create the world outside that we want to live within, and that we do have the power, we do have the energy, we can get it. So how do we do that? First, we need to liberate ourselves from enemy images, to think that the people who are running things now, the gangs that are creating the pain, we certainly have to relieve ourselves of enemy images, to not think that there's something wrong with the people who are part of these gangs. Now, that's not easy to do. It's hard to see that the human beings who are doing that are human like the rest of us. That's why the first thing we do with people when we're training them how to tackle these gangs is how to do the despair work that's necessary. And that means looking inside and dealing with your own pain in relationship to the gangs, to transform all the enemy images you have of the other people just into what needs of yours are not getting met. And then we show people that no matter what level the social change, even if you're trying to tackle a big gang like a government or a multinational corporation, that basically what it boils down to, the change will occur when a significant number of people radically change how they see things within that gang, and they see more effective ways of getting their human needs met than continuing the gang behavior. So once again, we see that we try to get change not by destroying the structures that are there, but by connecting with people within those structures to see more effective ways of meeting their needs that also meet the needs of others as well. So we want to change some multinational corporations and their practices, not because we convince them that they're evil people who are destroying the environment and oppressing people from other countries because of hiring practices and other trade practices. No, we want to connect with these people within these gangs, to show them how you cannot meet your own needs at other people's expense. So we want to help them get clear what their needs are and to find other ways of transforming their organization to better meet their needs at less cost to themselves and other people. Now, this kind of communication can be time-consuming and difficult because it could be that it's not one or two people that we need to have this connection with and have this transformative experience with. Because some gang behavior, to change it, might need millions of people to act differently. For example, if this gang is a government, we might need to get a certain percentage of the population to see more effective ways of meeting their needs than the present gang is doing, and to see other ways of meeting those needs. Sometimes the gang might be four or five people who control it, have the top positions, and if they can see other ways of getting their needs met that's less costly, more effective, we can bring about the social change we want. But in any event, it's usually more than one person can do. So we then need, as part of our social change efforts, to connect with other people who share a similar vision. And so in nonviolent communication, we then show how nonviolent communication can be used to identify those people who share your vision of the world you'd like to create, the structures you want to create, and then to create a team working together to bring about these changes. Now, very often, these teams we get involved in to bring about social change then have wars within themselves, because we're very often carrying within ourselves skills that do not lend themselves to good teamwork. So even though we're trying to change outside structures that seem very large and seem a big task, then it seems even more difficult because our group within gets into inner warfare. So in our social change efforts, we show social change teams how to use nonviolent communication to work better as a team, to make their meetings more productive. For example, I was working with a team of citizens in San Francisco, a team of minority citizens who were most concerned about the schools that their children were going to. Their interpretation of the schools is that it was destroying the spirit of their children. And there were certain structures that they wanted to change. However, they said to me, "Marshall, the problem is we've been getting together for about 6 months to try to create social change, but all we do is get into arguments or unproductive discussions, and we never get anywhere. So can you show us how nonviolent communication can help us build a team, make more effective use of our meetings?" So I went to their meeting, and I said, "Have your usual meeting, and I'll see if I can show you how nonviolent communication can be used in making your teamwork more effective." Well, the first thing that was brought up in this meeting, one of the men had clipped an article out of the newspaper, and it was an article of how parents were accusing a principal of abusing one of their children, and the principal was a white person and the child was a minority person. And so he read this article. And then another man responded to it and said, "That's nothing. I went to that same school when I was a kid. And let me tell you what happened to me." And then for the next 10 minutes, everybody was talking about things that had happened to them in the past and what a racist system it was and so forth. I let this go on for about that length of time. And I said, "Excuse me, I'd like to ask you all, raise your hand if you found the meeting to this point productive." Not one hand went up. Here this group of people had been getting together to bring about change in a system, and had had 10 minutes of a discussion, and nobody found it productive. These people had to leave their families to come for that meeting. It wasn't easy to find this time and energy. So when we're trying to tackle gangs, structures, social change, we can't burn our energy out with unproductive meetings. So I went back to the gentleman who started the conversation, and I said, "Sir, can you tell me what was your request of the group? What did you want back from the group when you read that article from the newspaper?" He said, well, I thought it was important. It was interesting. I said, I'm sure you thought it was interesting, but notice that's telling me what you think. I'm asking, what did you want back from the group? He said, I don't know what I wanted. And I said, that's why I think we had 10 minutes of unproductive discussion. Because whenever we take the attention of a group and present something and we're not clear what we want, it's a very good likelihood that we're not going to have a very productive encounter. So nonviolent communication shows us whether we're talking with an individual or a group to be sure that you end whatever you're saying with clarity about what you want back. What is your request back? By just presenting your pain or your thoughts without a clear request is very likely to be the stimulus of a very unproductive discussion. So this was one of several ways we showed the people how nonviolent communication could be useful in making their meetings more productive. I was working with another team of minority citizens wanting to change hiring practices in another gang in the city. It was a government gang. I think it was in the health services department. But they were concerned about the hiring practices of this gang. They felt the hiring practices were oppressive because they discriminated against certain people. So they wanted me to show them how nonviolent communication could be helpful to them in getting their needs better met by that gang. So we worked at nonviolent communication for 3 days. I showed them the process and how it could be used. And then they would go out that afternoon and come back the next morning and we would see how it went. The next morning they came back very discouraged. And one of them said, we knew it wouldn't work. There's no way to change this system. I say, okay, I can see you're really discouraged. Yes, yes. So tell me what happened so we can learn from this. And the team of six of them had gone into this administrator's office and they told me how they had used nonviolent communication very well. They hadn't gone in and diagnosed the system as oppressive and they had been real clear. They made a clear observation of what was going on, the law that they were concerned about that didn't allow for the hiring of certain people that they felt was discriminatory. Second, they expressed their feelings, how painful it was for them because they had a need for work and a need for equality and they felt they could do this work and how painful it was for them to be excluded from this work. And they made a clear request of him saying exactly how they would like to see the hiring practices changed to better allow for them to be hired. So they told me how they said it, and I was very pleased. They incorporated beautifully the training we had gone through. They had made real clear what their needs were, what their requests were. They didn't use insulting language. And I said, I like how you express that, but what was his response? And they said, oh, he was very nice. You know, he said, thank you for coming in. It's very important in a democracy that the citizens express themselves, and we encourage that in this organization. But at the moment, your request is quite unrealistic, and I'm sorry that it won't be possible right now. But thank you for coming in. And I said to them, then what did you do? Well, we left. I said, wait a minute. What about the other half that I showed you? How to hear behind that bureaucratic ease? What was in his heart? What was he feeling? What was he needing? Where was that human being in relationship to what you wanted? Oh, one of them said, we know what was going on in him. He wanted us to get out of there. Well, even if that's so, what was going on in him? What was he feeling? What was he needing? He's a human being. What was that human being feeling and needing? Well, they forgot to see his humanness because this is within a structure, you see. And within a structure, he was speaking structure language, you see, not human language, the language of bureaucracy. As Walter Wink says, organizations, structures, governments have their own spirituality. And within those environments, people communicate in a way that supports that spirituality. So nonviolent communication shows us a way of, no matter what the structure, to cut through it and see the human being within it. So I could see that I hadn't trained them well enough on how to do that. So we practiced that. We practiced how to hear behind all that bureaucratic language, how to see the human being and make a connection that strengthens our ability to work towards social change with that person. So after our training at that level, they made another appointment with this man, and they came back the next morning delighted. Because when they saw what was behind his messages, they saw that he was scared. He actually shared their needs. He didn't like either to see how this law was discriminatory. But he had another need, to protect himself. And he knew that his boss would be very upset with this suggestion, because his boss was vehemently opposed to what they were after. So he had a need to protect himself and didn't want to go to the boss and help them to get this passed. So once this team of citizens saw what his needs were, they worked together, but in a way that got everybody's needs met. What happened is he mentored them. He led them through what they would need to go through to get what they wanted. And they met his need by protecting him, by not letting anybody know that he was mentoring them. And they got the change in that structure that they wanted. So a very important part of social change is, again, not to see the people within these structures as enemies, to try to hear, even if they're speaking the language of the structures, how to see the human being behind it, but to persist in keeping the flow of communication going so that everybody's needs get met. Another social change project that I was involved in involved me with a street gang. I worked with this street gang when one of the members and I happened to come into contact, and he thought that what I was offering, if it was adjusted to his culture, he thought it could be very helpful. So I was working with this gang, and we subsequently, over years, did a lot of work together in school desegregation work throughout the United States. But one thing that we wanted to do together as part of social change was to create a school that would show that the students who were now being kicked out or pushed out of schools could be educated if they were educated in a way in which the teachers and the students worked as partners, not in which the teachers tried to control the students. So part of this social change was to first have a school that was a demonstration school in which we would show that we could reach the students that were usually being kicked out or pushed out of schools. And then to use this as a step toward broader changes in the school system. However, the first part of this required to raise some money, because for the project that we had in mind to create this school would require $50,000 to pay the teachers and get the school and so forth. And this is a very important part of social change very often. How do you get the resources that you need? So I learned a lesson from this gang member in how to make the best use of a short period of time when you are in social change efforts. This is very important because there's obviously a lot of communication that needs to go on in some social change efforts. Some communication organizing your team. Some communication getting access to key people that you need to talk with. So we need to not only speak nonviolent communication from the heart, but we need to be brief and clear and make the most out of short periods of time. So I learned a good lesson this one day from the gang member that I was working with. He said to me, "Why don't we go down to that foundation that you've been doing some work for? They give money. Why can't we go down there and get the money for this project?" "Yeah," I said, "I sure would like them to do it, but I know that right now that they don't accept applications for another couple months. This quarter is over. And not only that, in order to get money from them, you have to have a big proposal, and, you know, that we don't have the time or the resources right now to get that kind of proposal done." He said, yeah, that's one way to do it, but can you get the appointment?" I said, "Yeah, I can probably get the appointment with this person." He says, "Well, get the appointment and let's go down there and get the money." I said, "What are you going to do if I get the appointment?" He said, Let me handle it. So I called up and I said, "This is Dr. Rosenberg. I was working last month with the administrators, and could I have a meeting with the president?" And the secretary said, "Well, you know he's very busy, Dr. Rosenberg, but I'll see and call you back." So she calls me back and says, "We can fit you in between meetings. He'd be glad to see you, but it'll only be about 20 minutes. How's that, Dr. Rosenberg?" I said, "Thank you, yeah." So as we're driving down, I said, to my colleague. I said, now, what are you going to do during this 20 minutes? He said, let me handle it. Let me handle it. So we get into the meeting, and I politely introduce the two of them. I say, Dr. X, this is my colleague, Al. And Al, this is Dr. X. And Al reaches over, shakes his hand, and says, hi, brother. Where's the money? I could have beaten him on the head with a broom. You know, I was so embarrassed that he would start a professional meeting like this. See, my usual approach would have been to go in with a proposal and slides and to try to document all of the value of what we were trying to do to get the money. But this man is starting just the opposite. He's saying, we're here to get some money. What do you need to hear from us to decide whether you want to give it or not? So now this man was not used to this way of somebody starting. He kind of, in a very polite, laughed, what money? And my colleague said, money for the fun school. The fun school, what's that? It's a school Rosenberg and our gang is setting up to show that kids kicked out of school can make it if they're treated differently. What is this fun school like? But now notice what he's done. In our precious time, instead of our going in and filling the airspace with what we think the other person needs to hear, he started off from the very beginning by essentially saying to the other person in his cultural style, what do you need to hear from us to give us what we came for? And let the other person direct where the conversation goes. We walked out with $50,000. And over the years since that happened, which is about 30 years ago, I have used that principle repeatedly in my social change efforts, not necessarily starting as he did in his cultural style, but to begin the dialogue by setting it up from the very beginning where the other person can find out from me what they need to hear to decide whether they want to support the change that I'm interested in or not. I used that principle once with a key committee in Sweden, made up of top government people and top business leaders, and there was a social change project my colleagues there and I wanted to talk to them about supporting. And it took us some work to get to this committee, part of one of their meetings, but they finally did agree to give us 20 minutes at their meeting. So I was sitting waiting, and while my colleague and I were waiting, the secretary came out and said, Dr. Rosenberg, I apologize, but the committee wants me to tell you that they're running a little late, and instead of the 20 minutes that we said we could allot you, we only have 5. Okay, well, if I only have 5 minutes, all the more reason to use what I learned from my colleague. So I go into this meeting, and in my way, I told them exactly what I hope they would agree to. And what do you need to know from me to decide in this 5 minutes whether you want to agree to that? They took 40 minutes asking questions. I didn't. They directed it. But even if they had only given me the 5 minutes, I think I can get more out of it by letting them tell me what they need to hear rather than my using a lot of words that isn't going to help. So that's another application of social change and how nonviolent communication can be applied, how to get these important meetings, most productive, not filled with just a lot of words, but to create a flow in which the other person can tell us what they need to know to decide whether we can work together.